Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's Monday, 3rd of February. February the 3rd. The 3rd, as they say in Dublin. It's the 3rd of February. Hope you've had a good weekend and you're in, that you're in reasonably good spirits this Monday morning. This is the live stream newspaper review bollocks on YouTube, the Richie Allen YouTube channel, where we take a look at the front pages mostly of mostly the UK newspapers, it must be said, and look at one or two of the stories inside as well. Yeah, lots to talk about this morning. Looking forward to your comments too. You can chime in. You can chime in, be Jesus, by leaving a message on the live chat there. I'll be only too glad to read them. I'll read a few of them out as I go along. Lots come in, you see. Lots of messages. Some people think that their messages are ignored. They're not. I've got this tiny little screen here, you see. Look at me there. That's me there, talking away there. About 15 seconds delay. And the messages, they just go, whoosh, they scroll up very quickly. Nice weekend here. Nice and relaxed. Well, as relaxing as it can be when you're chasing a small dog around the house, constantly telling it to drop whatever it's got in its mouth. But other than that, it's been nice. Let's look at the front pages of the papers. What we're going to do today is we're going to skip some of the papers because every single newspaper in the country is carrying the same story on page one. And that is, unsurprisingly, news of a violent attack in London, in Streatham, in London yesterday, where a man allegedly attacked some people, injured a couple, stabbed a couple of people before being shot dead by the police. You can see him there, the man in question. He might have a bigger picture. There he is. Right, that's the guy who was alleged to have done it. Similarities to the London Bridge attack being that he had been released early from prison. He was in prison having been convicted of terrorist offences and he was let out on licence. Apparently a few days later, he attempted to kill people in Streatham. We'll talk more about that as we go along, who the guy is and where he came from. And the very nature of the attack, I think, is interesting. How he carried it out is very interesting. It's also very interesting for somebody who spent most of the last 20 years working in media, commercial and national and independent. And I've been to university, postgraduate degree courses in television and radio. In the independent media, I'm fairly uniquely qualified to comment on what's happened to the media over the last two decades. If you're watching, just for sake saying, Sky News this morning, you're hearing presenters like Kay Burley and Adam Bolton. Bolton follows Burley on Sky News every morning. And the script or the copy, which is relayed to the presenter on what is known as autocue. So when the presenter looks at the camera lens, which is a square thing, right? The text, the script, the copy is there. They look right at the camera and they read the autocue. And they generally control the speed of it themselves. You can't see them doing it. They've got a little button on their desk in front of them. And the copy or the autocue is the same. It's quite extraordinary. The opening sentence at the top of every hour is, "Terror has returned to the streets of London." Now, that mightn't mean much to you. Maybe it mightn't mean anything to you. Maybe you would hear that. You would watch a news programme and you would hear that and you wouldn't bat an eyelid. It wouldn't mean anything to you at all. But it means a lot to me. Because the television news programmes don't, as I've said 1,000 times now in the last couple of years, are not reporting the news. They are not investigating a set of circumstances. They're storytelling. They're narrating a story. Terror has returned to the streets of London. Would have been unthinkable some years ago as an opening pitch, an opening gambit from a news presenter. I've written 1,500 million. I've written 10,000 scripts in my time for television and radio. And the script would be, how would I write that? I would write it as two people remain in a stable condition after they were stabbed by a man wielding a knife in the Streatham area of London yesterday afternoon. The man was shot dead by Metropolitan Police, who have said that they believe that this was a terrorist incident and that the man was planning on murdering or was planning on doing as much damage. You get the picture, right? Two people remain in a stable condition, having... That's how it would have been. But now, terror has returned to the streets of London. That's a movie poster slogan. Tagline, isn't it? It's not the news. It's not investigative journalism. It's not news reporting. It's storytelling. And that's what your news... It's why a couple of years back it's not often I utter anything that even approaches profound. I'm not very profound, me. But a couple of years ago, I did say something in the spur of the moment that caught on. I said the BBC and Sky News represent a clear and present danger to every man, woman and child in the UK. They're not there to investigate, to challenge, to hold to account. They are storytellers. And it's shocking to me. And maybe you might understand what I'm saying. Maybe you don't. Hi to Liz McFall. Thanks, Liz, for your contribution this morning. I really appreciate it, Liz. Long time listener to the radio show and supporter. Thank you, Liz. Means a lot to me. Thank you very much. Let's go to the papers. Storytelling. Terror has returned to the streets of London. It's unbecoming that of any organisation that claims to be journalistic in nature. There's the front page of The Guardian. Terror attacker freed from jail and on police watch list. Okay. Let me just bring up the BBC. I still haven't figured out how to... it's because I'm a bit of an idiot. To show you live websites, while I'm looking at websites that I can display it to you, I haven't figured it out yet. And I probably won't ever figure it out. So don't get excited. The man is pictured there. He's been named as Sudesh Aman. And he was released from prison only a couple of weeks ago. Sudesh Aman. Okay? Okay. That's The Guardian. Like I said, we're not going to do all the papers because every one of them leads with this, understandably. Here's The Star, freed to go on rampage. Sudesh Aman, who knifed two, tracked by officers after early release. He's shot dead in street while wearing a fake suicide vest. Parallels, of course, with the London Bridge attack, which happened in December. Mid-December, I remember. Okay? Again, same thing. Guy had been out on early release. It was believed he was reformed, that he recanted his beliefs, repented, and was going to get on with his life. But all of a sudden, he's in London and he's attempting to kill people. Right. Express, same again. Knife jihadi freed days earlier. Let's get rid of it. No need to keep going. Like I said, we're going to do a couple of them. High Street terrorist freed from jail early. That's the iPaper. The Times. Terror returns to the streets of London. Very interesting. Now, you can go to Sky News on YouTube, and one of the lovely features of Sky News on YouTube is you can scroll back 8 hours. So you've got 8 hours. You can watch it live, and you can shuffle back 8 hours. So if you don't believe me, and there's no reason why you wouldn't believe me, because I've never lied to you in all the years I've been talking to you, or exaggerated, right? Terror returns to the streets of London. It's the first statement out of the mouths of Kay Burley and Adam Bolton. That's not journalism. That's storytelling. Telling a story there. You might say, well, isn't that the job of the newspapers, Richie? To take some facts and to tell a story around them? No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Newspaper articles, yes, have been referred to through the ages as stories. But this is hard news. It's not a feature. It's hard news. It's supposed to tell you what's happened. And they're supposed to look for any gaps, any inconsistencies in the information that is coming out. That's their job. Is there any inconsistencies? Well, there are lots. And we'll talk about them in a minute. There are lots of anomalies yesterday, you know, popping up all over the place. And you don't have to be Holly Dummigard or any of these other idiots in the truth or industrial complex who say fake news and actors and false flag every time. I don't do that nonsense. I found a couple of glaring problems with this story yesterday. And I'm not, you know, Inspector Clouseau or Inspector Columbo either, for that matter. Even Inspector Clouseau would have problems with this story. I'll tell you why in a minute. And I'm not going to dwell too long on it either, to be honest. Financial Times: Nissan draws up plan for UK pivot if Brexit leads to EU trade barriers. A lot of talk about the UK government saying that what it will and what it won't do in trade negotiations with the European Union, which will go on for some months now. We're in the transition period. The UK hasn't left the European Union. It hasn't. Okay? No, it hasn't. And it won't ever properly leave the European Union either. I'm tired of saying that, to be honest. Here's the Telegraph. A freed terrorist strikes again. Same story. Okay? The man, Sudesh Aman. Okay. And that's the last newspaper now we're going to look at the front page of, because the rest of them are the same. Uniformity. They're all doing the same thing this morning. Okay then. Couple of problems with the story. Let me just read you what the BBC is saying before we look inside the papers. The national broadcaster. I wish I could show you the website here. Right, Sudesh Aman was released about a week ago. Now he's 20, he was 20 years old before being killed by the police yesterday. He was given a jail sentence of 3 years and 4 months for terror offences. And he's released after serving half of it last week. He was under active police surveillance when he allegedly stabbed a couple of people on Streatham High Street in London yesterday. Police were following him. This is why they were able to kill him very quickly. 3 people were injured, according to the Beeb. None are in life-threatening condition. None of them are in any danger. That's a good thing. It's a good thing. Although, again, yesterday, the sense of disappointment from the 24-hour news channel presenters. It was palpable, the fact that 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 people weren't killed. That's why this morning, Kay Burley, the Ginger Ninja, presented her Kay Burley at Breakfast fucking rubbish news programme from Sky News Studios. If a few people had been killed, Kay would have been broadcasting from the scene, shoveling bucket loads of pathos down your throat and listening to Londoners talk about the need to come together and to unite and how they'll never defeat us and our values. But we didn't get any of that because nobody was killed. Okay. He was under surveillance, this guy. And he was under very heavy surveillance. Question number one for the UK fake fucking journalists. Why was this guy released? First of all, he was given a very light sentence. 3 years and 4 months. Released halfway through it. He had amended his ways. He was rehabilitated. Why was he under such close surveillance? They were virtually on top of him as he was walking around London. Lots of men, some of them wearing fucking balaclavas. Why? I don't know why. It might be perfectly reasonable. There might be a perfectly rational explanation for it. Why is the news media not asking the question? They're too busy telling stories. Right? Right. Question number one. Why were they following him so closely? Question number two becomes apparent when you hear from the witnesses. Before we hear from the witnesses, here's a video that's done the rounds of Twitter yesterday, although I think Twitter at one stage gave up trying to delete it. This is the aftermath of the shooting, the immediate aftermath. I don't know what you can see or hear here, but have a look at it. There's armed police rocking up there. This guy's already been shot at this stage. They back off when they think that he's got a suicide vest. A guy with a balaclava on there. Yeah, all right. The balaclavas can be explained away because the guys who actively surveil terrorists and are members of the armed response unit, they generally try to keep these guys anonymous, keep their identity secret. But I don't know what's going on there. You can make what you want out of that bit of video footage. So let's have a look then at some of the other extraordinary facts that emerged about this attempted mass murder by this terrorist yesterday. And this one I just can't get my fucking head round. I've mulled this over all morning. He grabbed the knife near the till and then ran out and began stabbing. How prepared was he? This guy came out of jail last week. He had a very light sentence of 3 years and 4 months. He served half of it. He came out of jail, right? Let me bring this up. He came out of jail and got a fake suicide vest, wandered down Streatham High Street, went into the low price store just before 2 o'clock on Streatham High Road, and without warning, he grabbed a £3.99 knife from a display unit and rushed outside and began to stab people with it. That's fucking horse shit. That's horse shit. I mean, that is horse shit, right? We're to believe that the guy set off from his house under surveillance so close that he could probably smell their breath. He could feel their breath on the back of his neck. They were that close to him, these guys. And he headed off with his fake suicide vest and no weapon. And he went into the low price store and then grabbed a shitty knife from a display. A shitty knife, right? And decided he was going to go on a stabbing spree. I don't buy it. And no reasonable journalist in the world would buy it. But also, no reasonable journalist in the world would state it to be untrue. I can't state it to be untrue because I don't know. Might be the case. Might very well be. I don't know. But it's incumbent upon the BBC and their competitors to be asking that question this morning, to be a bit sceptical, to say, why did this guy not have his own knife? Why did he not have something that, you know, he was confident that he would be able to cause a lot of damage with? Why didn't he have something on his person that would give him a better chance of doing more damage? Why did he just randomly grab a shitty knife, right, from a display unit, and then run outside the shop like a madman and start stabbing people? I'm going to make a suggestion in a minute now, and some people won't like it, because I can't support my suggestion with any evidence. But I'll make the suggestion in any case. So that's in the Times anyway. Kiranjeet Singh, who owns the store, I would have died of fucking fright. I would have died of surprise if the low price shop owner had been a guy called John Smith. You racist, baldy, gammon bastard. Kiranjeet Singh. Anyway, he said his brother was working at the shop when he noticed a customer who looked suspicious. He recognised him because he had come in the week before and didn't buy anything. My brother said he grabbed a ceramic 10-inch kitchen knife hanging by the till and ran outside. The shoplifter turned left and ran towards the White Lion pub, where he attacked his first victim. My brother chased him, but he tore off the wrapper and stabbed a woman in the back. He stabbed another man in the side, who was more severely injured than the woman. The knife man looked extremely angry, like he was on the warpath. He was a big guy and had a metal tube strapped to him. It looked like a bomb. Another guy was smoking outside a takeaway when he heard a man screaming along the road. Next thing I saw was a guy on the floor with blood around him. Yeah. Same story in the Star. Streatham terrorist grabbed $3.99 10-inch knife from shop before brutal stabbing spree. Right. Okay. Do you believe that? Do you believe that, as a set of circumstances, that the guy left home with the intention to maim or to kill people, that he had murderous intent in his heart, and yet all he had on his person was a fake suicide vest? Do you believe that? I don't believe it, because it doesn't make any sense. Dear viewer, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I don't know what else to say about that, other than we saw the same scenario in London, December. Guy released from prison who'd served some time for terrorist offences, rehabilitated, we were told, went to an event on London Bridge, started stabbing people. The immediate response from the government is, going to have to end early release for these types of criminals. We'll have to increase sentencing, all the usual stuff you'd expect from the government, draconian stuff. In the absence then, the big vacuum then, the glaring questions, the obvious questions not being answered, not being asked, let alone being answered. These guys are on top of him, following him everywhere after he was released from prison. Why? Ah, you might say, well, it makes sense, Richie, because of what happened in December. They're not going to take another chance. They're not going to get caught again with their trousers down when another guy's released from prison. Maybe. It might be true. What about this idea that he was in the shop and he just grabbed a knife and ran out stabbing people? That doesn't sound like something that was planned. That sounds like something that was on the spur of the moment. That sounds like the man snapped. That the decision to do that was instantaneous. Not thought out. Not pre-planned. And in that instance then, what about these guys that were following him very closely? Mind control? Maybe? I'm reluctant to say it, reluctant to suggest it, but we know it's possible. In fact, we don't know that it's possible. We know that it has happened. We know that the ability to do it has been around for a long, long time. The means to do it, to interfere with somebody's thought processes, to induce somebody into doing something that they wouldn't ordinarily do in their right mind, we know that it's possible and that it has been possible for a long time. I don't know. But I know I don't believe the official story. And I can't say any more than that. I'm sure you have your opinions. And I'll scroll through a few of them now in a minute. Crazy. Crazy. It's just ludicrous. You know, if you're planning on martyring yourself, you know, if you're planning on causing death and destruction in the name of jihad, in the name of your Islamist cause, you're not going to go out of your house without a weapon. You know, down Streatham High Road, the chances of you being able to get a weapon and then in the same instance go and stab people, the chances of you being successful in terms of killing people and lots of people are minimal. They're minimal, people. You know? So I'm not buying it. And I can't say any more than that. All right, let's leave that alone then. And move on. The BAFTAs were last night. We're held last night in London, presented by Graham Norton. It's the UK's Oscars, I suppose. British Academy Film Television Awards, I think. BAFTAs, anyway. It was notable, last night's BAFTAs, for the amount of talk about equality and inclusivity and commentary around the fact that none of the acting nominees were black or were an ethnic minority. BAME, as they have come to be known, British, Asian, minority, ethnic. Everybody who was nominated was white. And in the lead up to the BAFTAs, we heard a lot about this, didn't we? There was a lot of talk about it. So we got a few mentions last night. The Duke of, what is he? Cambridge, is he? William made reference to it, sharing his frustration at the lack of diversity at the white-dominated BAFTAs, and he joked about the how many winners have come from shows depicting members of his family. William there, and his wife. All right? You can read all about this if you want. The Daily Mail, dailymail.co.uk. It's free to read online. Joaquin Phoenix, who's a pretty good actor now, I think it's fair to say, said he was conflicted about the award he received. He received the Best Actor Gong for his portrayal of Joker in Joker, which I think he does a good job. It's a pretty decent film. I found it to be a decent film. Do you want to hear what Phoenix said? Here he is.
And the BAFTA goes to Joaquin Phoenix for Joker.
So he's getting his award there. He's coming up to get the award. We'll hear his speech in a second. We'll go back to the volume there. There he is. I don't know who that is. It's one of the UK lovies. Is it Olivia Colman, is it? Is that her name? Does she play somebody in The Crown, the Queen, does she? I think. Let's hear what Joaquin Phoenix said. This is all very woke, this. Here we go.
I feel very honoured and privileged to be here tonight. BAFTAs have always been very supportive of my career, and I'm deeply appreciative. But I have to say that I also feel conflicted, because so many of my fellow actors that are deserving don't have that same privilege. I think that we send a very clear message to people of color that you're not welcome here. I think that's the message that we're sending to people that have contributed so much to our medium and our industry and in ways that we benefit from. I don't think anybody wants a handout or preferential treatment, although that's what we give ourselves every year. I think that people just want to be acknowledged and appreciated and respected for their work. This is not a self-righteous condemnation, because I'm ashamed to say that I'm part of the problem. I have not done everything in my power to ensure that the sets I work on are inclusive, but I think that it's more than just having sets that are multicultural. I think that we have to really do the hard work to truly understand systemic racism. I think that it is the obligation of the people that have created and perpetuate and benefit from a system of oppression to be the ones that dismantle it. So that's on us. Thank you.
How lovely. Joaquin Phoenix there. And that clip was courtesy of the BAFTAs. All right, let's get rid of it. Can we get rid of it? We can. It was said during the week, wasn't it, that the men, it's mostly men, I believe, who make these decisions for BAFTA, it was said that they're largely unknown, that nobody knows who these people are. I don't know if that's by design or it's just happenstance, you know, it's one of those things. But I'd be seriously tempted to sue some of these fucking idiots for libel. You know? Because they pretty much non-stop for about 2 weeks, various journalists and Hollywood A-listers and B-listers have declared that the men making these decisions on which films to nominate are, you know, are intrinsically racist. You heard Phoenix there. Systemic racism. You know, the decision to... The films that were picked and nominated and the actors and actresses that were picked, those decisions were based on the systemic racism of the British... the BAFTA panel. Just racist. It's amazing. I'd seriously be going to a lawyer, to a solicitor, saying, because it's an open and shut case there. It's a stone cold case of libel. You know, I'm sure those guys, I don't give a shit if they're 55 or 65 year old white guys. I couldn't give a shit, really. I'm sure they've worked in film and television. I'm sure they're fairly qualified to make a decision on a film or on a performance based on their own knowledge of the craft, of the skill. Right? And I'm sure that when they make their decisions, those decisions are based on quality of performance, quality of cinematography, quality of direction, rather than on what a person looks like or sounds like. And I'm pretty sure if you look back over the years, been plenty of black men and women received the major awards at the BAFTAs, which, you know, flies in the face of the notion that racism was the motivation for this year's selections. It's astonishing to me that they just put up with it and they don't speak up and say, no, racism has got nothing to do with it. We chose the films on merit. The films we chose, we felt, were the outstanding films of the year. End of story. But they don't. Nobody says anything. Sadly, you're going to see more and more and more of this as well as time goes on. You're going to see more and more of it. Here's an interesting story about coronavirus in the Star. Apparently, according to a rabbi, a prominent rabbi who's a Bible scholar, the virus was predicted thousands of years ago in biblical code. Sort of thing that gets a few laughs, this. But I've interviewed people over the years whom I've enjoyed speaking with, clever people who've looked at Bible codes and have, you know, made a, if not made a compelling case, certainly made an interesting case that you can read into biblical text, you know, messages. And not just messages, but predictions of things that might be coming to pass. And this is in the Star if you want to read this, because I noticed some of my radio listeners are very much interested in this type of story. Guy says coronavirus is predicted in the Bible. And he goes on to talk about eating live animals, you know, which is demonic, satanic. He doesn't say demonic and satanic, but it's an interesting one. It's in the Star today. Found that interesting. Coronavirus, biblical codes. We might get into that sometime. Interesting stuff. On that, on the esoteric, if I dare claim religion to be esoteric, there is no life after death is a story in the Express today, express.co.uk. And it's an American scientist who believes that he can prove that it's impossible for there to be life after death. I won't get into it here because I don't have time. But it's all there, right? I don't believe him, by the way. I don't believe that you can prove that there is no life after death. He basically claims that he can prove that consciousness, post-mortem, is absolutely impossible. It can't happen. I don't believe it. Not because I don't want to believe it. I'm very open-minded. I'm not a religious man. But I don't believe that, you know, consciousness dies with the physical death of the physical body, the expiration of the physical body. I don't believe it. I mean, I don't know. I can't prove anything, but I just don't believe it. So I find that kind of interesting. What else is there? Stephen King, the author, whom I've been a bit of a super fan of. He's off Facebook, is Stephen. He's fed up of Facebook failing to deal with fake news, basically, and fake political ads, lies being told through political campaigns on Facebook. King believes that Facebook isn't doing anything about that and has deleted his Facebook account and has told his, it has to be said, hundreds of millions of readers. He's told them, you can find me on Twitter. He's got a Twitter account with a large following, has Steve. He's gone very woke, Stephen King. Speaking of the row around awards ceremonies, Stephen King, I thought very sagely, a couple of weeks ago, tweeted that, you know, that he doesn't look at performances based on anything other than performances. Diversity doesn't come into it. And he got attacked by the woke, and the coward rolled back and flipped. He flip-flopped on his position. And then he said that basically everything is racist. It's incredible, really. It just took one Twitter storm for King to change his opinion entirely. Mad. Crazy times. Imagine being scared of what people say about you on Twitter. Imagine that. Imagine. Very funny, isn't it? And of course, and I'm going to say it again, and I know it'll bore you. I've had it. Nobody in 2019 got it as bad as I got it. In July of last year, and I just laughed my fucking ass off at these Zionists and Jewish groups and Jewish newspapers and UK journalists trying to destroy me and get me off Twitter and putting my address online and threatening my missus. I just laughed at them. Laughed. I never batted an eyelid. Never sweated. Never bothered. And drove them away. So it's crazy to me that people would be scared of being criticised on Twitter by people you've never met. I just find it hilarious. You know? Amazing. What happened to the notion that there's no such thing as bad publicity? I was fucking thrilled last year when these idiots were, you know, trolling me and my timeline on Twitter and accusing me of heinous things. I thought it was fantastic. Keep it up. BBC asking me to be in documentaries. Brilliant. Keep it up. You know, you're driving legions of people towards the Richie Allen radio show. Please continue. You know, the idea that you would wilt under that and change what you're saying or delete your Twitter account, fuck off, right? Give me a break. My god, man. Yeah, this is in the Times. EU fears new migrant surge from Libya. Why? Well, because Libya is Mad Max beyond Thunderdome. It's a fucking basket case of a country. Why is that? Well, just ask David Cameron and Barack Obama and that fucking twat Nicolas Sarkozy. Ask them about why Libya is a basket case. Previously peaceful country under Gaddafi or Qaddafi, Muammar Qaddafi. We came, we saw, he died, said Killery. Country's now a fucking basket case. The Times, Oliver Moody, reporting from Berlin. Brussels is worried that the deepening humanitarian crisis, well, could leave Libya ill-equipped because it's going to be overwhelmed with migrants. Let me read that again. I made a buzz of that. I made a Lee Rhodey of that. Brussels is worried that the humanitarian crisis in Libya could leave it could leave Libya's Coast Guard overwhelmed. Yeah. So basically, Brussels is worried that Libya won't be able to stop or prevent a surge of migrants leaving the country and heading for, well, for Italy and Southern Europe, Croatia, Turkey. I know Turkey's not in the European Union. Stop shouting. I know that. But gain entrance into Europe through Turkey, Croatia, Balkan states, Greece, through Italy, of course. Because Libya is a basket case. The North African state, says the Times, has been torn between two warring factions, the government backed by the United Nations and the rebel GNA led by General Haftar since 2014. Growing concern as General Haftar's forces advanced deep into Tripoli and seized the port city of Sirte. Conflict is threatening to devolve into an international proxy war as the two sides suck in support from overseas. Basket case. Hundreds of thousands dead in the last few years. Carnage, chaos, trauma. What has it done to the children of that region? The blood, the mayhem, the carnage, right? And let us never forget. Let us never forget. Back in 2016, Crispin Blunt, who was then the head of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in the UK, and this cost him his job. Cost him his job. He reported at the time, so he did, that the bloody collapse of Libya, this is 4 years ago now, was David Cameron's fault when he intervened to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi. The report published by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, which I've mentioned quite a bit on this programme, as well as the radio show, condemned the campaign in 2011, the military campaign, for lacking accurate intelligence and a coherent strategy for the aftermath, for life after Gaddafi. The disastrous results were political and economic collapse, tribal warfare, the refugee crisis, widespread human rights abuses, and the rise of Islamic State in North Africa. Fueled by weapons abandoned by Gaddafi's regime. Many of these lunatics went to Syria, where they were rebranded by the Western media on the orders of Western governments, because that's what the media does. The media takes orders from governments and corporations. We'll write what you tell us to write. Okay then, well, we're telling you to say that there are moderate rebels in Syria. Moderate rebels. Good guys that want to throw out the brutal Assad regime. Okay, we'll write that then. When the truth is, these were lunatic head choppers that came from Saudi Arabia, came from Afghanistan, came from Libya. And that the whole purpose of overthrowing Gaddafi and making Libya a beyond Thunderdome lunatic post-apocalyptic fucking nightmare was to feed jihadi fucking head choppers into Syria and elsewhere. It's part of a plan. It's not bad management or mismanagement or unforeseen circumstances. That's what they would have you believe. Poor planning. Poor planning. They overthrew Gaddafi, but they didn't give any thought to what would happen after. They gave plenty of fucking thought. That's the whole point. But your whoring media never goes down that avenue, does it? Never turns that fucking corner or opens that door. What if? What if the Beyond Thunderdome situation in Libya now was the end result that was desired all along? Ah. Mayhem. Carnage. Death. Destruction. The sacking of states. The partitioning of states. Which is what they still desire for Syria. Because they failed to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. So now they're thinking, they're still thinking, well, if we can only divide the country in half. Yeah, Crispin Blunt lost his job for that. They brought in a Zionist called Tom Tugendhat to replace him. Tugendhat has since moved on, it must be said. Evil, you know, you're surrounded by pure, fucking, undiluted evil. Everywhere. And nothing stands in its way. Except a few fucking independent radio shows. And we don't even reach 0.00001% of the fucking population. So what chance do you have of getting, you know, people to take a look at a different narrative? Fuck this truth or shit. The truthers. I'm not a truther. Dean Henderson is not a truther. Michael Rivero is not a fucking truther. You're asking people to have a look at another point of view. That this is all by design. This lunacy. And of course, you connect the dots like Ike has said for years. You'll realise that what happened on the streets of Streatham yesterday and what happened in London Bridge or on London Bridge in December, all of it is related. Because you have to be conditioned. You have to be conditioned to accept what's coming down the line. Unbelievable, huh? Does anybody in the media ever ask, why wasn't David Cameron arrested for war crimes? Why wasn't Tony Blair arrested and interviewed under caution for playing a direct role in the deaths of millions of people based on monstrous lies? You know that he knew he was lying. That isn't in doubt. You know that he wrote to George Bush saying, no matter what, evidence or no evidence, we're going to support you. It's all there. You don't have to build a case against Tony Blair and David Cameron. Their own public fucking utterances, their own public statements, hanged him. Lying about the threat from Gaddafi and the threat of Libya, lying about what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, that resulted in the deaths of millions of people. Those guys are multi-millionaires now. They travel around the world now, giving speeches to universities, to academics, getting paid six figures a time, while people in Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan and Yemen and Syria are burying their fucking dead, trying to find the bits of their children. The fucking arm over there is a leg over there. I think the child's head is over fucking there. They don't go to prison. The International Criminal Court just goes after. You want fucking racism. You want systemic racism. The International Criminal Court in The Hague. There's your systemic fucking racism. If you want to find it. What are we investigating this week? A load of black dudes. A load of black dudes who ran militias in Africa, in the Congo. Let's get some fucking guy from the Congo and try him in The Hague because he killed a few hundred people in a village. Fuck yeah, by all means. By all means, do. He did kill a few hundred people in a fucking village and burn them to death and rape their fucking children. He did. But he's fourth division compared to Tony Blair and David fucking Cameron. Fourth division. You know? What about Bush? Well, the United States isn't signed up to the International Criminal Court. It doesn't fucking recognise it. But the UK does. Any time they want, they can put the cuffs on Blair or David Cameron. Any fucking time they want. You know, we are signed up to it. Blair and Cameron are bound by its jurisdiction. Anytime. Any fucking time he's in Europe, he can be fucking cuffed. Come with us, son. Why? Well, there's 1.5 million reasons in Iraq alone. You fucking scumbag. Off to The Hague with you. No, no, we'll find a few black dudes. There's some black dude in Senegal. Some guy in Nigeria. Let's justify our existence and our annual funding by bringing some fucking court cases against some fucking Egypt who killed a few villagers. Yeah, yeah, he's a... I'm not going to say it. He's a Cupid stunt. Try him. If he's found guilty, bang him up. But he's fourth division. Fourth division. He's fourth division. Compared to Blair and the other scumbag. Cameron. This is crazy shit, isn't it? Crazy fucking shit, this. This guy's lost his... He's blown his top, this father. Lost his cool. When a kid came home, 12-year-old kid came home with an assignment from his religious education course to write about the murder of James Bulger. What the fuck is going on there? Kid's going to have nightmares, says the father. 12 years of age. Why is he researching the case of Jamie Bulger? Why? Well, it's all about a lesson on good and evil. James Bulger was abducted in Merseyside, 1993. He was taken to a railway line and he was bludgeoned to death by two very young boys called Robert Thompson and John Venables, or is it John Venables and Robert Thompson, of child murder in UK history. You know, it's up there with the Moors murders. Dreadful, dreadful, dreadful thing. How two young boys could do something like that. They were 10 years old, those boys. What was going on in their lives that they could sadistically murder a baby boy like James Bulger. But Rob Gregg's got a kid in Bicester, Oxfordshire, Cooper School. And his religious education homework project was to research the murder of young Jamie Bulger. I can't make a case for it. You know, you try to be a bit distant when you look at these things. You try to be moderate and say, all right, right, you know, don't just have an emotional reaction to it. It's easy to have an emotional reaction to it and to go, what the fuck? It's easy to do that. Just take a step back and see, can you make a case for it? No, I fucking can't make a case for it. And there's the paper there. There's the homework assignment. And, I mean, what's going on in schools? I mean, could it be any more patently obvious now that there is a programme to completely fuck with the minds of our children? Fuck their minds just right up, like. No child aged 12 should be asked to contemplate the brutal murder of a baby by two boys aged 10. What the hell is going on there? It was a very carefully considered decision, said the school, introducing this to the curriculum. Jesus Christ. I don't know. If you're a first-time parent, or if you're a first-time parent-to-be, are you really going to send your child through the UK education system? Are you going to put your child or children through the UK education system in 2020? Really? Because we wouldn't. Not a chance. You haven't a fucking Scooby-Doo what's going on in schools these days. You only know what they're telling you. You have no idea what else your children are hearing or being exposed to. So, don't send them. I'm not telling you what to do. Don't send them. I wouldn't send them. Madness. Right, 10:25. Enough of me. I don't know anything about what happened in Streatham Road yesterday. Okay? I just can't, you know, I can't in good conscience take at face value what it is we're being told. Some of you have said on the chat there, it's possible, Richie, people, of course they do. I can't rule it out. Of course people snap. I wouldn't rule anything out. I don't tell you what it is or what it isn't. On any subject, when have you ever heard me say, this is the way it is? I don't know. It's pure conjecture from me on this. I can't buy this thing that he came out last week, having been found safe for release, being monitored around the clock by GCHQ's finest, and then went out unarmed, apart from a toy suicide vest, and just grabbed a knife in a discount shop, or a discount store, as my American friends would say, and ran out onto the street and started randomly stabbing. No, I don't believe it. Yes, I believe that he ran out of a shop and stabbed people. Of course I can believe that. It appears that two people were stabbed. There's photographic evidence of it, I believe. Right? I don't believe the witnesses are actors on Sky News. I believe it's genuine. The guy's 20 years old. Is he that sophisticated that he could fool the probationary people, the probation officers? Could he fool the psychotherapists, the psychiatrists? Could he fool them all that he was safe to release? Maybe he could. Again, I don't know. But I'm sceptical. I find it very dubious. And if he was a calculating, cold-blooded jihadist, he didn't give himself the best chance to inflict maximum damage yesterday afternoon, did he? These are questions the fucking media should be asking. It shouldn't be left to the likes of me to ask them. Right? So there you go. That's all I have to say about that. I'll be with you at 5 o'clock today, 5 o'clock UK time, usual channels, for the Richie Allen Radio Show. Until then, have a good Monday. Mind yourself. Bye.